Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, sports fans. It is Sunday, August 10th, 2014. We have a full slate of NFL games to talk about. We got the NFC South preview, and we got some Mets talk today. But right now, we're back in the saddle. And a good morning to everyone. How is everyone doing? I am your host, Ryan Stern. Welcome to a new episode of Beyond the Bench. We are brought to you, as always, by BackSportsPage.com. Everyone make sure, check out the website. Follow them on Twitter, at BackSportsPage. Facebook.com/BackSportsPage. You can find me on Twitter at rstern33bsp. The show is on Twitter at Beyond the Bench and on Facebook at facebook.com/beyondthebenchbsp. How's everyone doing? We got football. I was lucky enough to go down to Canton, Ohio last weekend. I'll definitely bring you some of the stories, what I saw, what I experienced. Today we will be joined in any minute by BackSportsPage founder Randy Zellia. He was at the Giants-Steelers game yesterday, covering from the press area. So we'll check out what Randy was able to see yesterday. We will also be joined sometime around a little before 10 o'clock by Michael Barron. He writes for MetsBlog.com, which is a part of SNY. For you non-New York area listeners, SNY is the TV home of the New York Mets. And their website through SNY.tv, they have Mets blog, and Michael Barron will be joining us to talk some Mets baseball, as this team just doesn't go away. And it's a real different feel about this team this year than it has been in the past few years. But let's... and before we get into our NFC South preview, I said we will be joined any minute by Randy Zelia. Giants. All right, it's preseason. But if there's one thing that has really stuck out to me is the play of the defense. Their defense has been really good. They did allow the one little quick hitch to Jeurie Archer. And for those of you who aren't NFL Combine people, Jeurie Archer ran the second fastest time in the history of the Combine behind Chris Johnson. Chris Johnson ran a 4.24. Jeurie Archer ran a 4.28, I believe. This kid can fly, and if he has any open space, he's going to hurt you. And if it weren't for a great read by Prince Mukamara, he would have taken that to the house. But the Giants' defense stepped up. They really did. The only touchdown that the Steelers scored yesterday was on a fumbled backwards pass by Ryan Nassib late in the game. A lot of people don't realize, especially with the fact that the Giants opened up 0-6 last year, the Giants' defense was a top 10 defense in the NFL. And with the additions that they made, this can ultimately be a real good defense. They have four starting caliber cornerbacks once they get Tremaine McBride back. They already had Prince Mukamara. They brought in Dominique Rogers-Cromartie and Walter Thurman III, both from winning programs. So they bring experience and they bring a winning attitude to the team. Jamil McLean has looked very solid as a linebacker, filling in the spot that that John Beeson is leaving open until he gets healthy. And the one who is really opening up eyes is rookie linebacker Devon Kennard. This kid's just making tackles everywhere, whether it be first team, second team, special teams. This kid's making tackles. He's making plays. And he's already jumping in to talk to be a starter. And also Jaquan Williams. Jaquan Williams has had a real good camp so far, and he's had a real good first two games of the preseason. He's made great reads on two throws. He's going to have to start to catch a ball. He's had two interceptions come right to him, and he's dropped both of them. But he's made great reads. And the Giants linebacking core, which had been a weakness over the past couple of years, seems like it may be a strength this year. And I really do think that this is going to be one of the more underrated defenses in the game. I think they're going to cause turnovers. With Stevie Brown back there, if he can regain the form that he had before he tore his ACL early last year, I think it was in the final preseason game last year. If he can regain his form, they always have Andrell Roll, who may be the best tackler in the NFL. But, yeah, that should be very interesting with the Giants. And all right, so until we get a call in from Randy Zelia, we are going to hop into our NFC South preview. And we'll open up with the team that won the division last year, and that's the Carolina Panthers. There isn't a lot that the Carolina Panthers did to make you believe that they're going to retain that title. They lost a lot, and they didn't replace much of it. They lost, and yeah, sure, he's near the end of his career. I understand that. But Steve Smith was a leader on that team and one of the real comfort receivers for Cam Newton. He's gone. The Carolina Panthers have zero catches on their roster from players who played with the Carolina Panthers last year as wide receivers. Zero. Their top four receivers from last year, all gone. Steve Smith, now member of the Baltimore Ravens. Brandon LaFell, now member of the New England Patriots. Dominic Hickson, now member of the Chicago Bears. Ted Ginn, now member of the Arizona Cardinals. This is a real questionable receiving core. Yeah, sure, Jericho Cotchery is a nice receiver. He's near the end of his career, and he hasn't been a number one guy since his early days with the Jets. He had 10 touchdowns last year as a member of the Steelers. You cannot ask for Jericho Cotchery at this point of his career to be a 10-touchdown guy. It's just not going to happen. They brought in Jason Avant from the Eagles, who was always a complimentary player, had troubles with drops. He's a pretty good route runner. He can score, he can make some big plays, but he's definitely not anybody who you can rely on. They have Tyquan Underwood, who hasn't been able to stay on a roster in his career. Tavarus King, who friend of the program at Beyond the Bench, is going to have to do a lot to get onto the field because he just hasn't had any opportunities to prove himself in the NFL. And the big question mark of this team is going to be Kelvin Benjamin. Can the first-round draft pick, who didn't amount many catches last year, as a member of the national champion Florida State Seminoles, he's a red zone guy who can make plays by throwing him up the ball and letting him use his size and athletic ability to go get it. He's not a polished route runner. He's very raw, and the Panthers are going to ask him to start. And I wouldn't be surprised if they ask him to start in the X, which means he's going to see a lot of number one cornerbacks in the league. And I do not think that at this point of his career, Kelvin Benjamin, and even though there are rave reviews about him during camp, I don't think Kelvin Benjamin is ready to be a number one receiver. Which is why I think, especially for you fantasy players, as you know, I always like to stick some fantasy references in. If you're not going to grab one of the top three tight ends, which would be Graham, Gronk, and Julius Thomas, if you're sitting there in the middle rounds and Greg Olsen is still on the board, go grab him. If there's one thing that Cam Newton knows in this offense, it's where Greg Olsen's going to be. He had maybe the best year of his career last year, and I really think that this is especially for touchdowns. I really think that he's going to be the primary target in the red zone. So Greg Olsen is one of my top performers this year when it comes to the tight end position. But then you look at what they lost on the offensive line. They lost the cornerstone left tackle of the franchise in Jordan Gross, who retired. Now, they have Byron Bell is penciled in to be the week one starter at left tackle. Over at right tackle, they have Nate Chandler. They have rookie Trey Turner out of LSU at right guard. Trey Turner isn't, and there are some times that you see, oh, okay, you have a rookie, sure. He can separate. And Trey Turner was, I believe, a third or fourth round draft pick. And now he's going to be starting. That's how in need of bodies this offensive line is going to be. I do not like any of the running backs, even as mid to late round players. D'Angelo Williams is going to give you two or three games that he's going to say, that you're going to say, where has this been all year? But that's all. That's it. All you're going to get from him is two or three games. Jonathan Stewart, guy's never been able to stay healthy in his career. Kenyon Barner, a second-year kid out of Oregon. Tons of potential. He can't stay on the field. That's a real, real rough backfield. The only guy who you can really count on in that backfield is going to be Mike Tolbert. Mike Tolbert, who really coined the term vulture when he was out in San Diego. Now he comes in and if Cam Newton's not keeping the ball himself, he's handing the ball off to Mike Tolbert. Those are the two main runners in goal line situations, Cam and Mike Tolbert. And Tolbert just doesn't get enough reps in between the 20s to make him a viable fantasy option. The only way that the Carolina Panthers have any chance of retaining the title in the NFC South is if their defense plays even better than it did last year. And that's going to be tough because they lost Mike Mitchell, who was one of the top safeties in the league last year. He's now a member of the Steelers. They lost Captain Munnerlyn, who had a career year last year for the Panthers. He's now a member of the Vikings. But that front four is among the top front four, if not the top front four, in the entire NFL. Anchored by Charles Johnson, Greg Hardy on the ends, Starlow Tulele, Colin Cole in the middle, and then you also have Kwon Short. That's a real good defensive line. And then you have maybe the best middle linebacker in the entire game, Luke Kuechly. It was the emergence of Luke Kuechly that made John Beeson available for a trade last year, which really turned the Giants season around when they acquired Beeson. But Beeson just wasn't able to get on the field because he's your prototypical middle linebacker. And Luke Kuechly just has to be on the field. He's a three-down linebacker no matter what. And he's anchored by Thomas Davis and Chase Blackburn. The front, that's as solid a front seven as you're going to see in the NFL. the real question is going to be whether or not Antoine Kayson and Melvin White can really hold down the fort on the outside. They brought in Roman Harper to play opposite Thomas Dekeu. As a strong safety. It's a questionable secondary, but hopefully for the Panthers, the efficiencies of the front seven are going to make up for what they may not have in the secondary this year. The Carolina Panthers, I do see taking a step back. I'm looking at somewhere like maybe a 6-7 win season this year. So when you're looking at they're coming off a 12-win season last year, 6-7 wins is a major drop-off. And I do not see the Carolina Panthers making any run at the playoffs this year. But when you talk about drop-offs, there is one person that you can count on who will never give any sort of drop-off, and that is the founder of BackSportsPage.com, the one, the only, Randy Zelia. Good morning, Randy.
That was not a bad segue. I was as the anchor man would say, that was kind of impressive.
Hey, I'm a professional here. I don't get paid like a professional, but I do consider myself to be a professional.
Hey, listen, not for nothing. None of us get paid like we. If we all tried to put the right amount of dollar amount on the value we all think we have, we'd all be millionaires. So, all the NFL players and professional athletes get paid over their top dollar value. Good morning, Mr. Stern. I will tell you that there is a lot of excitement going on with a lot of different things, especially with the NFL season. Upon us last night, I had the honor and privilege of being at the Giants-Steelers game, because I think that game set the game of football back about 40 years.
Aside from the long run by Rashad Jennings, it did seem to be as boring a game as the NFL can produce.
Yeah, that game last night set the game of football back at least 20 years. There's not a doubt in my mind that this is not what they had in mind when they made the game of football. So,
no.
I will agree with that. But I'm ready for your questions. Shoot, go ahead. What do you got for me?
One thing that I'm most interested about with the Giants is going to be that final wide receiver spot, which coming into camp seemed like Mario Manningham was going to be penciled in as that final receiver that was going to make the roster.
Thank you.
And now it seems that with Manningham not being able to make any plays, and now the Giants have had two preseason games, and both of them have you have game-winning touchdowns by Corey Washington. Do you think that this kid Washington has the shot to being able to step in and make the team out of camp?
Victor Cruz Part 2. That's what they were calling him in the press room last night. Victor Cruz Part 2. I'm going to give you my assessment of both teams. I'll go with, if you want me to do Steelers first, I'll do Steelers first. If you want me to do Giants first, I'll do Giants
Let's get into the Giants.
Good. Here's my biggest concern with the New York Giants. The defensive line at times last night was a little shaky, but they were very, very solid. I love their special teams. Their special teams did a great job. That offensive line needs work. And I'll be honest with you, this is going to sound crazy, but Ryan Nassib has dramatically outplayed Eli Manning so far in the preseason. Eli Manning looks like a shell of his former self, and his former self was very inconsistent at best. So, that offense scares me. But the defense looks like it's coming together. The Giants' defense needs – one of the biggest problems last year with the Giants' defense was their inability to cut down the big plays. Last season, they gave up a lot of big third-down plays, which if you were a fan, just broke your heart. And I said it last night because there was a couple times where you felt that they gave the first team gave up the proverbial big play when Pittsburgh had that long run right in the first quarter. The rest of the game, they did a pretty good job shutting down, but obviously you don't get the real good feel of the team during these preseason games. Usually by week three, you have a good feeling of what your team is. I don't like what I'm seeing from the offensive line. Eli says that there was – I went to Eli's press conference last night, said there were some positive things going on there. He said he saw some improvements. I'm trying to grasp it that, you know, that I'm – me being the Giant fan that I am, I'm still saying 9-7. But watching the first two games so far has given me not given me as much confidence in that 9-7 pick. So I might have to revisit my picks as the season gets closer. But the Giants, until they really shore up that offensive line and give Eli the protection he needs, I just don't. It's hard for me to stand by that 9-7 pick right now.
No, I was talking about the Giants a little bit before you jumped on the program. And I'm not saying that they're going to be the Giants' defense of the mid to late 80s, the ones that were anchored by LT and Carl Banks. But if this team is going to make any, I guess, real attack at the playoffs, it's going to have to be because the defense is carrying them. I'm almost comparing them. I know you're not a hockey guy, but I'm comparing them a little bit to what the New York Rangers went through this past year. Again, new system. And also, it's an offensive-based system. And the Rangers came out of the gates really slow. And it wasn't until Christmas time, so you're looking at 2-3 months into the season, that they really started to gel as a team. And I know that in football, you're not allowed 2-3 months to give yourself to start gelling. It's going to happen sooner. But again, with the Rangers, they had the defense and they had Henrik Lundqvist. The Giants, I think, are definitely going to rely on their defense to get them through the first maybe 2-3 games until we really start to see any sort of gelling with this first unit.
Well, I will tell you that I think we'll know what the Giants are the first two to three games of the year. If they end up going 0-3 again, obviously it's going to be a lost season. Their schedule is a favorable schedule the first half of it. That middle part?
when you have to play the Colts, 49ers, and Seahawks in three consecutive weeks, that's if you can get one out of those three, it's a win.
Yeah. I think it's going to be an uphill battle for them. That's why and just the way they look, it just feels like it felt like watching a broken ship sink last season. That's what it was last season. It was a broken ship. You know, at times it looked like the ship was going to survive. And it was like, okay, we're heading to shore, It's still breaking down, Oh my God, looks like we're going to sink.
Yeah.
And, they were able to survive it and get back to shore, and now they have to fix the ship. And now they're trying to right the ship and fix the ship. And they're doing like little test runs right now to see if it's going to float. And now they keep, they have to fix the anchor, which is Eli, and that's the hard part. So, it's gonna be a quick thing. Ryan, I only have a few minutes with you today, but real quick with the Steelers. General consensus: I got to see quite a few Steelers games last year, and Roethlisberger only played one series. They know what they have. They're trying to break in a new receiving core, which that's why surprised me. Ben only played one series. But they're going to be in the mix of it for that division. That division is not a strong division. It's really up in the air. So it's going to be very, 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 very interesting to see what's going to happen in the AFC, that central division there with them, Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Baltimore.
Yeah, we call that the AFC North in these necks of the woods.
Okay, fine. You call what you want. I'm going to call what I want. All right.
Well, I mean, it was the AFC Central maybe about 20 years ago.
Listen, I'm with the times. Ryan, have a good rest of the show, buddy. Listen, hopefully next week I'll be able to come on a little longer with you.
All right, everyone, make sure to tune in to Real Sports Talk Radio with Randy Zelli and Mike Tramontazzi on Wednesday nights at 7:30.
Yes, right now, well, actually right now we've been on hiatus. I think we're coming back this week. We'll, I'll know tomorrow, and we'll, you know, we'll listen to the show. We'll have fun. It's basically a two-hour party, you know what I mean? And it's like a siesta for your ears, so it's awesome. So, all right.
I think you mixed up siesta and fiesta with party, but I think you may be more on track with the siesta.
On that note, good night, everybody. I'll see you later.
Randy, we'll talk to you soon. The great Randy Zelia, as always. It was a quick but good insight to what he saw from the Giants. Not trying to get off track. Let's hop back into to the NFC South. Next team finished in a virtual tie with the Carolina Panthers, but lost due to tiebreaker, was the New Orleans Saints. And I really think that this year is just absolutely primed for the Saints to get back and make a real run at the Super Bowl. Drew Brees doesn't have much time left. This may be one of his last elite seasons. And there's one stat that really blew me away when I really sat down and looked at it. There have been 8 times in NFL history that a quarterback has thrown for 5,000 yards in a season. Half of those times have been Drew Brees. This is an elite quarterback, no matter what way you put it. This offense is tailor-made for Drew Brees to be successful. Yeah, they lost Darren Sproles. Darren Sproles wasn't healthy for a good chunk of last season. They bring in Brandon Cooks. Brandon Cooks, I feel, can do a lot of similar things that Darren Sproles was able to do. And when I was at the draft and they read the name, New Orleans Saints select Brandon Cooks, it was sort of like that, are you kidding me? Did they just get that much better? Because Brandon Cooks was higher on my board than he was on a lot of boards. I loved what this kid, because I don't think he's just a slot guy. I think he can play outside. I think he can play an H-back type role. I think he's multidimensional, and he's going to be perfect for that Saints offense. Marcus Colston, yeah, he's getting up there. He's had some issues with staying on the field. Who knows if he's going to be able. But Marcus Colston, again, he's another one who's going late in drafts. I've seen him go 7th, 8th round. You're talking about the number one wide receiver on maybe one of the 2 or 3 most prolific offenses in all football. It's a steal if you can get Marcus Colston as your wide receiver 3. It's an absolute steal, and that's where I've seen him go in a lot of mock drafts that I've taken part of. Another one, Kenny Stills. Kenny Stills, is primed for a breakout season. And Kenny Stills is one that I've seen, you can get him in the 12th, 13th, 14th round. I don't think it's fair that I'm going to load up in other positions, and I'm going to grab one of these two later in my draft. I'm going to get Marcus Colston, and if he goes before I'm ready to take him, maybe I'll go around earlier than I would have taken Kenny Stills and grab him, because I want some part of this offense. They have a crowded backfield, and it's gonna. That's why you're not seeing any of the running backs really go any earlier than they should. But Pierre Thomas should definitely be owned in every league. Kyrie Robinson should be owned in every league, because I think you're going to see Pierre Thomas maybe get into some of the Darren Sproles role, and I think Kyrie Robinson is going to be the primary ball carrier for that team. And then you haven't even gotten into Jimmy Graham. Jimmy Graham is as dynamic a red zone target as there is. He's as dynamic a seam runner as there is. And they have a pretty good offensive line. Teron Armstead, third round pick last year out of Arkansas Pine Bluff, who had a phenomenal combine that brought him from a 6th-7th round project into the third round, who ended up starting by the end of the year. Ben Grubbs, Jari Evans, Zach Strief. I mean, it's a good offensive line. This is going to be a prolific offense. They're going to score upwards of 24, 28, 31 points a game. Especially when they're at home. And what's really going to determine the success of the New Orleans Saints, as always, is going to be the play of the defense. Cameron Jordan, who I think is a budding star at defensive end. Broderick Bunkley, a real nice nose tackle. Junior Gallette, is one of the more underrated pass rushing linebackers that there is in the game. What's going to be, I think they're the middle of the linebacking core with Hawthorne and Lofton. That's a little questionable. If Keenan Lewis can stay healthy, Keenan Lewis can be a top 10, top 15 cornerback in the league if he can stay healthy. He hasn't proven he can stay healthy. Patrick Robinson, again, he's someone who's bounced around. He needs to be able to stay healthy. They bring in Champ Bailey. Champ Bailey is going to play nickel for them. You have one of the best cornerbacks of all time playing nickel. So it's an improved secondary, especially when you talk about if Kenny Vaccaro can stay on the field and Jarius Byrd brought in from the Buffalo Bills. This is the season. I think the Saints can wheel off 13-14 wins. And if they get those 13-14 wins, I think there's a good shot they end up with the number one seed. And if they end up with the number one seed, they're going to be really, really tough to eliminate in the playoffs because they don't lose at home very often. Next on the docket is the Atlanta Falcons. Again, this is a team that we are able to get a good little glimpse into, because of the fact that they're on Hard Knocks this year. And I love Hard Knocks. I'm not a big reality TV watcher. I watch America's Got Talent because I'm a Howard Stern fan. And I watch Hard Knocks in 24/7. I think anything that HBO does is tremendous. And Hard Knocks is as well put together as any show that you'll see, especially if you're a football fan. And the one thing that I am a little upset about with Hard Knocks is the fact that they are broadcasting one of the guys who I was hoping would be a sleeper and would fall to me in every league, and that's Devontae Freeman. Now, hopefully he struggles a little bit, and that's sort of what we're hearing, is that he hasn't really picked up the speed of the NFL game. But if he's able to work through that, he's going to see time, because you know that Steven Jackson isn't going to be able to stay on the field. He hasn't been able to do that during training camp. He's already nursing a hamstring injury, which nagged him, bothered him, kept him out for quite a bit of last season. If Devontae Freeman is able to pick up the offense, I think he sees more time than Jaquizz Rodgers, and I think can be a pretty dynamic player as a sleeper in your fantasy draft this year. Talking about the rest of the offense, Julio Jones coming back. When Julio Jones left after week five last year, he was on pace to have a historical season. I know it's tough to say that if someone has a strong 5 weeks, that's going to carry out through the whole season. But he was on pace to have 140 catches. I believe he had four touchdowns in the first five games. Julio Jones was on pace for a historical season. He was the number one receiver in all of football when he got hurt. And then Roddy White was bothered by injuries. And he wasn't the same player that we have come to see with Roddy White. And another one, Roddy White was another one that I was hoping in a lot of my drafts would fall to the fourth, fifth round area, because that's where I would nail him and I would get an absolute steal, because if you're watching Hard Knocks, you see Roddy White's healthy. And with an improved offensive line, I think that this can be one of the more dynamic teams in the NFL. I see them having a real bounce back, and if Jake Matthews can really nail down that right tackle spot, and I do think he will be able to. He's gotten some holding calls so far early on in training camp and preseason. But if he can develop into that solid tackle, I think this is going to be a real, real good team. Their issue is a real good offensive team, but their issue is definitely on defense. They did improve the defensive line. They're bringing back Croy Bierman, Osi Umenyiora, who was not the Osi Umenyiora that everyone's used to. They bring in Tyson Jackson, who had a good year last year for the Chiefs. They draft Rashid Hageman, who's going to play defensive tackle for them, I believe. They bring in Paul Soli from the Miami Dolphins, who had a real good year last year. So they definitely improved their defensive line, because their defensive line last year was atrocious. At linebacker, if Paul Warlow can stay healthy, he's one of the more underrated linebackers in the game. They draft Prince Shembo, who I think is a real underrated kid coming out of Notre Dame. They bring in Pat Anger, who had a real solid career so far with the Colts. But that's secondary. And it's funny, because you start to get used to saying this is a very questionable secondary. It's the teams that have the good secondaries that are going to be the real teams to watch, because it is a passing league and you need that strong secondary. And this just isn't a strong secondary. Desmond Trufant, Javier Arenas, who was supposed to be a franchise cornerback when they drafted him a couple years ago out of Alabama. He just hasn't developed into anything. It's a real, real questionable secondary, especially in the at cornerback. At safety, they did bring in William Moore, who he's okay. Nothing special. The front seven is going to have to greatly outperform what they're projected to do in order for the Atlanta Falcons to succeed. And real quickly, get into the final team, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. This may be a team that nobody's talking about that can really have a say into who makes the playoffs. I think the addition of Josh McCown, and Josh McCown, you saw last year, when he was successful with Chicago, it was with the two big receivers. He had Brandon Marshall. He had Alshon Jeffrey. Look at who now he has to throw the ball to. Vincent Jackson, Mike Evans. Yes, I know rookie wide receivers tend to not be able to pick up the NFL game right away. But Mike Evans is one of those guys that if you give him the opportunity to make a play, more often than not, he's going to make a play. I do feel that this is one of the more underrated secondary defenses in the league. They have one of the better secondaries in the league. And, I mean, you're looking at Mike Jenkins at corner. They have Mark Barron, Deshaun Golson at safety. That's up there, top five best safety pairings in the league. And I just really think that this is a team that can make some real headway. The key to this team, I feel, is going to be Doug Martin. If Doug Martin can get back to his rookie form, and it's a big question. We don't know if Doug Martin has the ability to do that. But he's going to be given the opportunity. And I feel that he's starting to slip in a lot of drafts. You're really starting to see Doug Martin fall even into the third round. And I know he doesn't excite you. It's not a move that you say, wow, all right, I got Doug Martin. Last year, it was, all right, I got Doug Martin. This year, it's a real question mark. And he does have some bodies behind him in Bobby Rainey and rookie Charles Sims out of West Virginia. But I don't think that either one of them pose any sort of threat to take a starting job away from him. I do feel that it's going to take either an injury or a real lack of production for Doug Martin to lose his spot. And one name that I forgot, they signed Alteron Verner, who as a cover two cornerback really thrived in Tennessee last year. Got a big contract and is, I feel, set to make that defense one of the better defenses in the game. And they're going to have to be because they play a couple real good offenses a couple times a year in the NFC South. I do think that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers finish in some sort of race for the bottom of the division with the Panthers. I can see them being a 6-8 win team. I'll give them 7 wins. But with that, we shift our attention to baseball, and more specifically the New York Mets, and we're going to welcome Michael Barron to the show. He writes for MetsBlog.com, which is a part of SNY. He's a photographer for SNY, and he also writes for MLB.com. How are you doing this morning, Michael?
Doing pretty well. How about yourself?
We're doing great. We're going to talk a little Mets, and there's a real different feel about this team this year than there has been at this point of the season the past couple of years, where even though they're still five games under 500 right now, there is some sort of feeling of hope, and it could be because now it really feels like it's a homegrown team where I know you have guys like Granderson there, but a lot of the pitching and a lot of the young kids coming up really makes Met fans want to watch this team.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a good point. Like you said, the record isn't where it needs to be or where we all think it should be, but you know, I think a lot of the pieces are finally starting to fall into place. You know, and there's more to come with Noah Syndergaard. You know, you're finally starting to see Travis d'Arnaud start to hit a little bit. You know, the young pitching, you know, sans Matt Harvey, you know, is starting to blossom, and you can now begin to see what everybody's been talking about with Zach Wheeler, what everybody was talking about, maybe to a lesser degree with Jake DeGrom. You know, and certainly the bullpen has rounded into form with, you know, finally a lot of the young fireballers who tend to miss bats. You know, in the past they preferred to trust a lot of the older veterans, but a lot of the older veterans they had were broken players at that point in their career. So, you know, it's nice to see these things, you know, as, you know, the foundation of what's to come. You know, there's still a lot of work to do. But, you know, even the players, you know, I talked to several players last weekend when I was at the ballpark, and they all agree that, you know, they'll basically say the same thing, that it's, you know, the feeling has changed, the pieces are starting to fall into place, and there's definitely a good feeling, you know, among those who are likely to be there, you know, in the clubhouse going forward.
Now, we all know that there's still six games out of the wild card two spot, and we all know that there was that, remember, when we lost the 7.5 game lead with 17 to go. Do you feel that there is enough firepower on this team to make some sort of run and threaten the likes of Pittsburgh, St. Louis, and San Fran for one of those two wild card spots?
Well, I mean, I guess you never know what's going to happen. And, you know, San Francisco, you know, as a good example, has not played very well this
up and down.
At least since June 1st. I mean, I saw them out in San Francisco, and I thought, you know, them, the Giants and the A's were the teams to beat. You know, I still think ultimately the A's will, you know, are the best team in baseball right now. But, you know, you never know. The Mets proved that in 1973. The Phillies proved that in 2007. With the exception of those Mets in 73 when it was an entirely different game. You know, the Phillies still had a very good record, and, you know, the Mets just fell flat on their faces that year. So, you know, a lot has to happen. They have to jump ahead of a lot of teams. They have to play. They have to jump ahead of the Giants and the Pirates, who they're not going to play again. So, you know, the odds are very long. But I think there's enough here to at least maintain some level of interest in the team, not necessarily for 2014, but certainly, you know, for, you know, in the short term in 2015, you know, who belongs and who doesn't, things like that. But, and if they make a run, you know, and they can, you know, they can jump ahead of a few teams and, you know, those pieces start to come together now, you know, great. I mean, that would be awesome. But I think, you know, that when you're thinking about playoff runs for a team that's six or seven games under 500, that's so far out, you know, just behind the second wild card, you know, let's just take it one day at a time and see where we are in a week, then, you know, see where we are in another week and see what's happening, things like that.
One of the best stories that you mentioned his name a little earlier, one of the best stories for the Mets this year has been Jacob DeGrom. He really wasn't on a lot of people's radars as being one of the top pitchers within the organization, especially when they've been throwing around the names of Noah Syndergaard and Rafael Montero for so long. And now this kid, DeGrom, has come up, and he's really established himself as a quality major league pitcher. Do you feel that the emergence of Jake DeGrom is going to aid the fact that now maybe they can trade one of the established major league pitchers along with another minor league pitcher for a bat maybe in the offseason?
Well, I think that has to happen no matter what, regardless of what DeGrom has done or hasn't done. He's been absolutely tremendous. And to be fair to DeGrom, I mean, they've been talking about him in similar light to, you know, the big three, you know, for quite some time now. I mean, I talked to a lot of people about DeGrom, you know, going back to when he's, you know, when he became a pitcher. And, you know, he's dealt with a lot of injuries, dealt with some inexperience, which is why he wasn't, you know, he may not have been on people's radars. But, you know, they've always felt the talent was there. And, you know, look, you know, when you look at guys like Harvey and DeGrom, what they've done early in their careers, you know, all you can do is say, okay, yeah, they have a lot of talent. You know, they're free and easy, you know, so on and so forth. But there's no way to ever predict, you know, how well they'll ultimately do. You know, you can set an expectation, but, you know, if they exceed that expectation, it's typically unusual, even for the best talents. I mean, it's fun to watch, but, you know, to say that he wasn't on their radar and, you know, is probably a little bit unfair. I think, you know, the injuries and, you know, his background may have hindered his reputation in the minors, but, you know, make no mistake, he performed at every level, at a very high level of the minor leagues, you know, leading up to his promotion, and, you know, it was certainly deserved, and I think he's answered a lot of questions. He's made it a little bit easier to absorb a hit if they do in fact make a trade during the winter. But I think, you know, even last year before Harvey got injured, they still needed to make a trade, you know, to get better, and they didn't do it. I think the same can be said today, regardless of DeGrom. I think it just makes it a little bit easier to, you know, to take that blow to the stomach.
One of the more surprising turnarounds this year has been the emergence of Lucas Duda as an everyday first baseman with the ability to hit for consistent power and drive in important runs. And we saw last night he had the big RBI single off a lefty in the 11th inning. What do you feel is the main reason for Lucas Duda's turnaround into becoming a real quality major league first baseman?
There are a couple things. One is confidence, and two is confidence. Confidence has always been his problem, and you know, it's not like that's a secret either. You know, he's talked about it for years at this point about, you know, the need to be confident. You know, his issues, you know, staying confident in the batter's box, not knowing what his role was, and I think what has helped him become confident was the fact that he became the full-time first baseman. And they said to him, they said, look, it's your job to lose at this point. You know, we traded Ike. You're the everyday first baseman. And I think, you know, getting up in the morning knowing, you know, he's going to be in the lineup and knowing what his role is, you know, that'll help any player. I mean, you know, I can think back, you know, over the years, you know, there have been countless instances like this where, you know, a player, you know, would fear an 0-for-4 would send him to the bench. And Lucas Duda might have been – I'm sure Lucas Duda was cognizant of that, especially with, like, Davis and his power potential. But now that nobody else is there to sort of take over for him, you know, he knows an 0-for-4 isn't going to land him on the bench tomorrow. So, you know, he has confidence in that. He has confidence in his ability. And obviously, the more you produce, the more confident you get in your own ability, because you say, hey, you know what, I can do this. And – you know, I've been waiting a long time for this, and I'm finally able to show that I can do it. And, you know, the evolution's been fun to watch. You know, is it sustainable? I don't know. I think the peripheral statistics would suggest that it is sustainable. He's a big guy. He has great plate discipline. He has great knowledge of the strike zone. And by getting consistent at bats, he's been able to apply that craft, you know, to his hitting. And here we are. He's among the top first basemen in home runs in the league. He's been one of the most productive first basemen in the league. And I think he's earned his keep. He's at least earned 2015. I think, you know, throughout the rest of the year, you know, he's going to get these opportunities to hit lefties consistently, which he hasn't gotten, you know, to this point this year. yesterday was a good test, especially, you know, since he came through in the clutch, which everybody seems to get on him for. So, you know, that was certainly a big hit for his in his season and to put on his resume for next year.
The major difference that I'm seeing in his approach this year from any previous year is the first pitch. I think they I remember there was a stretch last year where I think he took something like 48 first pitches in a row, and you're really starting. And there was a stat on the broadcast last night that he leads the major leagues in batting average at swinging on the first pitch, and I really think that has sort of given him that extra boost of confidence, knowing that he's ready to attack the ball if he gets a pitch to hit that first pitch.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I think, you know, since Lamar Johnson took over for Dave Hudgens, you know, I think that I don't want to say that the batting coach makes, you know, all the difference, but you know, certainly, I mean, you can look at that date as, you know, sort of you know, the turning point in his season to a degree. I mean, you know, before then, you know, to speak to your original point, you know, he was still taking a lot of first pitches, and he was falling behind in the count a lot. And it's difficult for any hitter to hit, you know, an 0-1, 0-2, 1-2 type counts. You know, those are pitchers, that's the time for a pitcher's pitch, an out pitch, you know, slider off the outside. And, you know, he struggles with off-speed pitches to begin with. So, but I think, you know, I don't know what was said to him, you know, but I don't know what Lamar Johnson may have said to him when he came in, but I think you've seen a clear transformation since then. And you know what? That's worth its weight in gold right there. I mean, the offense hasn't been good, you know, since he took over. But you know, if you can transform, you know, one or two hitters, you know, if you can change the approach of a couple of hitters, you know, that will only serve well for what's ahead for this offense. And it's certainly, like I said before, he's earned his keep for 2015. Which answers a question, you know, for off-season moves. And you know, you can credit his adjustments and his mild change in approach, you know, to that. You know, I think that's been a real key to his success, as you said.
What do you think if there is any difference difference in attitude that Bartolo Colon has brought to this, other than him, relatively young pitching staff?
Well, that's a good question because he's actually a pretty quiet guy. You know, he keeps himself quite a bit. You know, I've talked to him, you know, a number of times, and he does have a very interesting personality. He's a funny guy. When the Mets were looking for a starting pitcher to replace Matt Harvey for 2014, one of the things they were looking for was a veteran who has the ability to lead by example and or, you know, as a voice, you know, for the younger guys in the rotation. And, you know, I don't know if, you know, Bartolo Colon has a leadership voice, if you will, but he certainly leads by example. And a lot of the pitchers, you know, if you talk to, you know, you've heard a lot of the reports as well, you know, during the broadcast, you know, his ability to lead by example, you know, people have followed, you know, what he's done, you know, the pitchers, I should say, the starting pitch, the all the pitchers on the staff have followed what he's done, and that, I think, you know, is a check mark as far as him leading by example. You know, he's a veteran who knows what he's doing, you know, and one of the things I think he brings to the table is his ability to not get stirred up, even in the worst type of conditions. He has a bad inning, a bad game, never changes his demeanor out there. And I think you've seen that, you know, John Neese has had some lapses during the year, but you know, for the most part, I think that's been a common denominator for a lot of the pitchers. And look, it helps, you know, because it helps you keep your focus out there on the mound. But I think, you know, as a veteran, you know, his presence alone, just being able to watch him and study him, you know, has helped a lot of these younger guys.
One more before I let you go, and it was another thing that you had brought up earlier, which I believe is one of the major reasons why the Mets are in the contention that they are in, has been the performance of the bullpen. And you were so correct in your stating that the Mets used to just try and build with experience in the bullpen in the past. And Now you're really starting to see a trend throughout the entire major leagues of just putting these power arms in the bullpen and trying to blow you away late in the game, and the Mets weren't doing that. And now you are really seeing that they have three guys in the bullpen that have those power arms. What do you think the bullpen transformation has meant to the development of this team?
Well, it's huge. I mean, if you can shorten the games for the studs they have in the rotation at this point, I mean, you're going to win a lot of baseball games going forward. And, you know, like I said, the foundation of that is there. I mean, you know, just take any generic situation. You know, for first and second, or say second and third and less than two outs, who would you rather have out there, a guy throwing 85 who is likely to pitch contact, or a guy throwing 95 who's likely to get that strikeout and make it two outs? And, you know, instead of having infield in, now you can bring the infield back. It changes the entire scope and the entire situation for a team late in games, and it's really helped. And, look, let's not forget Josh Edgen. I mean, that kid's been tremendous mm-hmm. this year. I mean, he's made some key adjustments. The velocity's back. He's become their ace lefty in the bullpen, and that shouldn't take anything away from Dana Eveland, who's been a nice little crafty veteran down there. But, you know, you have two different looks from the left side, plus you have those three guns from the right side. And, you know, the bullpen is what now? They went from 24th in the big leagues when Farnsworth was here. They're now 7th. And it all comes down to their ability to throw to get big strikeouts, miss bats, you know, eliminate sacrifice flies, eliminate base hits with runners on late in games. And that's how you win, you know. And they struggled to keep runners off the bases, keep those guys from scoring, because they had an inability to get a big strikeout or a weak pop up or, you know, overpower somebody into a tight spot, you know. And you've learned a lot about Vic Black. I mean, he's still all over the place, but he strikes a ton of guys out. Henry Mejia has been very successful as a reliever. I think he has a 2.0-something ERA, you know, as a reliever, but he has that closer personality. You know, he's starting to develop a presence out there. And Familia is just, now that he's throwing strikes, is absolutely filthy. Is it sustainable? I mean, they're young. I mean, we'll see. You know, hopefully nobody gets hurt, and hopefully they continue to evolve and get better. But it's been fun to watch. I'm glad they finally decided to, you know, can the lightning in a bottle theory with broken relievers, and go with, you know, their internal talent. You know, and it's working. It's great. It's fun to watch, and they're reliable, and they're all very confident, and it's exciting.
Michael, I want to thank you for a couple minutes this morning. Everyone, make sure to follow him on Twitter at Michael G. Barron. And check him out, MetsBlog.com, and hope to have you on soon, maybe as the Mets are trying to make a run in September.
Well, let's hope that's the case. I had a good time. Thanks for having me.
All right, Mike. We'll talk to you soon.
All righty. Bye.
It's Graham Michael Barron. He's a great follow on Twitter. Real insightful, real responsive to his followers. And he's around the team. There aren't many people who can say that they're around the team, and he's one. And for those of you who are into photography, he gets some great shots. Check out some of his work there. And with that, we are going to wrap up. Actually, before we wrap up, let me get into my experience at the Hall of Fame last weekend. First of all, if you're going to make the drive from the New York metropolitan area, make sure you have another driver with you. Unfortunately, I did not have a second driver with me. That's a long drive. but I have to say it was well worth it. It was a bucket list item that I was able to check off, and I was able to see one of my favorite players of all time get inducted into the Hall of Fame, and Michael Strahan did not disappoint with his speech. And when you think about some of the words that he said that he's and improbable Hall of Famer. He was an improbable football player. And that's one of the things that makes him so great, is that he used that notion that he shouldn't have been in the NFL in the first place to make him better at what he did. And it was a real, and I thought it was a very inspirational speech that he gave. But when you talk about inspiration, there's no one else that you should really talk about in the NFL than Jim Kelly. And it was a pleasure to be able to see him and to see him there with Andre Reed, to see him throw that one last pass to Andre Reed on the stage, and to know what he's going through and to know how strong he's been and to know the inspiration that he's been to others who are facing the same situation that he is. But one of the things that I'm most thankful for was, I guess, the fact that Andre Reed got into the Hall of Fame was that it brought out all of the Buffalo Bills fans. And I've never really had the chance to interact with many Buffalo Bills fans. That is one hell of a fan base. That is as passionate, as loyal, as knowledgeable a fan base as there is in the entire NFL. And I know that they're worried that if certain groups buy the team, they're going to be moved. I really feel that if they are moved out of Buffalo, it's an absolute travesty, because that city revolves around the Buffalo Bills. And to all of you Buffalo Bills fans out there, I tip my cap to you, because the numbers that were there, the excitement that you guys showed for your team, your players, a guy that should have been in the Hall of Fame a while ago, in Andre Reed, finally getting in. It was a real pleasure to experience the Buffalo Bills fans last weekend. And it really has made me want to, at some point this year, get up to Buffalo for a game, because I would love to experience a home game with that fan base. It just seems like that's the thing to do in Buffalo. You go to a Bills game. That's what they do. And the one other lasting image will be of finally Ray Guy getting into the Hall of Fame. It's about time. I know that everyone mocks kickers, punters, but when you revolutionize a position, and that's what Ray Guy did. He revolutionized the position of punter, and really was the key benefactor to the term hang time. He changed field position and was one of the major reasons why the Raiders were successful in the 70s. It was, as someone who follows punters and who has been able to interact with the likes of Steve Weatherford, they're genuine dudes. I get that. That's all you can really say about punters, is that they don't get the love that they should. And it was a privilege to be able to be there and see the first punter get inducted into the Hall of Fame. With that, we will wrap up our show. You have been listening to Beyond the Bench. Stay tuned next week. We're going to have an extended preview show. We're going to wrap up the NFC with the NFC West, and we will break into the AFC, and we'll jump into the AFC East. So for those of you Jet fans, Dolphins, Bills, Patriots, Seahawks, 49ers, Rams, Cardinals, we'll break down those two divisions next week. We will have a fantasy expert come on next week to join us as we get set for the real heart of fantasy draft season. Once again, we have been brought to you by BackSportsPage.com, at BackSportsPage, Facebook.com/BackSportsPage. I'm your host, Ryan Stern. Follow me on Twitter at rstern33bsp. Follow the show at Beyond the Bench, Facebook.com/BeyondTheBenchBSP. And until next week, I hope you have a nice day.